Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. As the Senate gets closer to agreeing on some kind of infrastructure spending bill, which if Republicans and Kyrsten Sinema have their way will be stripped of any serious climate change policies, and as New York Governor Andrew Cuomo goes down in a ball of flames, or goes down with flaming balls as the case may be, now that he's been found by a special state investigation to have committed sexual harassment many times over and over a number of years while in office, and we cautiously approach the necessity of having to reimpose pandemic protocols thanks to the anti-vaxxers' gift of the Corona Delta variant. What's one person's passing but a brief blip in the news? But in this case, we've lost a very important figure in the organized labor movement. Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, has died unexpectedly from an apparent heart attack at the age of 72. Organized labor, meaning unions, has shrunk precipitously since the Reagan era, thanks in a large part to the Reagan era anti-union policies. The infamous right-to-work strategy is one. It forbids unions and companies that employ both union and non-union workers from charging dues to the non-union personnel for services provided by the union. If you're a non-union worker in a union shop, you may enjoy the benefits of a contract negotiated by the union, but under right-to-work, you don't have any obligation to support that union. Nevertheless, union organizing efforts are ongoing, and in some sectors, the teachers' unions, the nurses' unions, steelworkers' unions, and various federal employee unions remain strong. While they represent a shrinking percentage of voters, they're still enough to make a decisive difference in any close election. Therefore, the AFL-CIO, which is a coalition of many unions, is an important political player. In the past, with unions on the run, the AFL-CIO leadership nationally gravitated toward the political center, in a sense, and was not outspoken on a number of issues other than wages and benefits and labor law or international trade. But there are many more issues that affect union members, and when Richard Trumka, who was formerly head of the coal miners' union, was elected to serve in the AFL-CIO's top office, it marked something of a turning point as the AFL-CIO edged in the direction of progressivism and militancy. This happened after a long period of slothful neglect, during which time emerging labor constituencies, namely immigrants and service and agricultural workers, were organizing independently and forming their own separate coalitions. In 2008, a junior senator from Illinois claimed the presidency with the help of organized labor. We'll begin the show with Richard Trumka speaking in 2008 in support of candidate Barack Obama. You'll notice that he does so by addressing racism head on.
There's not a single good reason for any worker, especially any union member, to vote against Barack Obama. And there's only one really, really bad reason to vote against Barack Obama. And that's because he's not white. And I want to talk about that issue because I saw it myself in Pennsylvania in the primary. I went back to my hometown. I went back to my hometown in Nemacolin and I ran into a woman that I've known for years. She was active in Democratic politics when I was still in grade school, back when Abe Lincoln was born. She got to talking, and I asked if she'd made up her mind who she was supporting, and she said, "Oh, absolutely. I'm voting for Hillary. There's no way that I'd ever vote for Obama." I said, "Why is that?" She said, "Well, he's Muslim." And I said, "Well, actually, he's Christian, just like you and I, but so what if he's Muslim?" Then she shook her head and said, "Well, he won't wear that American flag pin on his lapel." And I looked at my lapel and I said, "I don't have one, and By the way, you don't have one on either, but come on, he wears one plenty of times. He says it takes more than wearing a flag pin to be patriotic. Well, I just don't trust him. And I said, why is that? And she drops her voice a bit. And she says, because he's black. And I said, look around this town. Nemacolin's a dying town. There's no jobs here. Our kids are moving away because there's no future here. And here's a man, Barack Obama, who's going to fight for people like us. And you want to tell me that you won't vote for him because of the color of his skin? Are you out of your ever-loving mind, lady? See, brothers and sisters, we can't tap dance around the fact that there's a lot of folks out there, just like that woman, and a lot of them are good union people. They just can't get past the idea that there's something wrong with voting for a black man. Well, those of us who know better can't afford to sit silently or look the other way while it's happening. Now, I'm not one for quoting dead philosophers, but back in the 1700s, Edmund Burke said, all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. Well, there is no evil that's inflicted more pain and more suffering than racism. And it's something that we in the labor movement have a very, very special responsibility to challenge. It's our special responsibility because we know better than anyone else how racism is used to divide working people. We've seen how companies set workers against worker. They throw white workers a few crumbs. They discriminate against black workers or Latino workers, and we all end up losing. But we've seen something else too. We've seen that when we have the courage, the good sense, the trade union values to cross the color line and stand together, arms locked, no one has ever been able to keep us down. That's why we created the CIO. That's why industrial unions were the first to stand up against lynching and segregation. People need to know that it was the Steel Workers Organizing Committee, this union, that was founded on the principle of organizing all workers without regard to race. That's why the labor movement, imperfect as we are, is the most integrated institution in America. Now, I don't think that we ought to be out there pointing fingers and calling them racist. Instead, we need to educate them that if they care about holding on to their jobs, if they care about health care, if they care about pensions and their homes, if they care about creating good jobs with clean energy, child care, pay equity for women workers, there's only one candidate on the ballot this fall who's on that side, only one candidate who's going to stand up for their families, only one candidate who has earned their vote, and that candidate is Barack Obama, and come November, he's going to be the President of the United States. And after he's elected, we're going to hit the ground running so that years from now we're going to be able to tell our grandkids that 2008 was the year that we finally turned it, this country finally turned its back on men like George Bush and Dick Cheney and John McCain. We're going to be able to say that 2008 was the year that we started ending the war in Iraq so that we could use money to create new jobs, building wind generators, solar collectors, clean coal technology, and retrofitting millions of buildings. We're going to be able to look back and say that 2008 was the year that the tide began to turn against the Rush Limbaughs and the Bill O'Reillys and the Ann Coulters and the right-wing race haters. Brothers and sisters, we're going to be able to say that 2008 was the year that we took back our country and built a government that embraced workers and loved unions and saw the power that we bring and the justice that we instill in a country.
Richard Trumka was instrumental in marshaling Ohio workers against a statewide anti-union bill known as Senate Bill 5, which would have practically eviscerated the union movement here. It was supported by Republicans and big business, but it was resoundingly defeated by the Ohio voters, thanks in part to massive education efforts by the unions. Here's a clip of a report from PBS's Judy Woodruff at around that time.
Now, public employee unions face a moment of truth about demands, concessions, and rights as the war over benefits and collective bargaining plays out in Ohio, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and elsewhere.
The latest flashpoint, Trenton, New Jersey. More than 12,000 off-duty and retired police officers and firefighters gathered outside the State House today. They rallied in opposition to Governor Chris Christie's proposed changes to pensions and benefits for many public workers. In Ohio yesterday, workers gathered as the Republican-controlled state Senate passed a measure that would restrict the collective bargaining rights of all unions. Known as Senate Bill 5, it would affect roughly 350,000 teachers, university professors, firefighters, police officers, and other public employees. The bill would ban strikes by public workers and penalize those who participate in walkouts. Automatic pay raises would disappear, and future wage increases would be based on merit, not seniority. Unionized workers could not negotiate on health care, sick time, or pension benefits. It's one of a number of measures backed by Republican governors in several states that challenge the very notion of traditional bargaining with public sector unions. Ohio Governor John Kasich praised the vote, which still must be approved by the state House, saying this is a major step forward in correcting the imbalance between taxpayers and the government unions that work for them. In Wisconsin, where Senate Democrats fled the state 2 weeks ago to avoid a vote on a similar bill, the deadlock remains. Reports said both sides are talking about a compromise. But Governor Scott Walker insisted again this week on Meet the Press that the state must pass a bill to curb collective bargaining to close a deficit between now and 2013.
Well, I ask you a more specific question, which is, what's wrong with collective bargaining?
Well, for us, it's about the fact that, again, as a local official, I can tell you personally, time and time again, because of collective bargaining, when we had tough budgets in the past, when I was at the county presiding as the CEO there, I tried to do modest changes in pension. I tried to do modest changes in health care. In fact, 1 year, I literally tried to do a 35-hour work week to try and avoid massive layoffs and furloughs. And the union said, forget it. Embodied, emboldened by the fact that they had collective bargaining agreements, they said, go ahead, literally lay off 400 or 500 people. And to me, laying off people in this economy is just completely unacceptable.
Indiana has also had its share of union battles. State House Democrats there are preventing action on labor and education bills they oppose, which would restrict some bargaining rights. Today, when most House Democrats skipped a floor session, House Speaker Brian Bosma said he was ready to start issuing fines and formal censures against them.
I would not want my name listed in the clerk's records of the Indiana House and the House Journal for posterity. It will very clearly describe the actions that have been taken and the cost to the taxpayer.
So far, the most contentious fights have been between labor unions, who tend to back Democrats, and Republican governors and legislators. But many more states are asking public sector workers to pay more toward their health benefits and pensions, including some led by Democratic governors.
One late-breaking development in Wisconsin, Governor Walker announced this afternoon that he plans to start laying off state employees tomorrow unless there's an agreement. Well, we talk about some pivotal questions facing labor now with its most prominent leader. He's Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, a voluntary federation of 57 national and international labor unions, many of them subject to the changes outlined in our Tate piece. We invited governors from half a dozen states, including Wisconsin and Ohio, to participate in tonight's discussion. All declined our invitation for now. So, Rich Trumka, thank you very much for being with us.
Judy, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
But let's start with this announcement today from Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin that he's ready to send out those layoff notices unless there's some kind of an agreement. Is that a price worth paying? I mean, he was suggesting there that that unions would rather see people laid off than make small concessions.
Well, first of all, it's the most outrageous thing that he's done. You heard him say that laying off was something we shouldn't do in today's economy, and yet he's putting this choice to those workers in Wisconsin. Either give up your rights or get laid off, give up your job. Now, no American should be put in that position. This isn't about the economics, Judy. They've already agreed, the unions have already agreed to the exact concessions that he's asked for. This is about him trying to take away the rights of workers to come together to bargain for a middle-class life.
But Governor Walker's argument, and I know you've heard him make it, is that with collective bargaining, he says unions have been able to, in effect, bleed the state of money that it doesn't have, that it's happened over years and years. Previous governors haven't done anything about it, and he said it's got to stop.
Well, quite frankly, I listened to him several times, and I've never heard him explain why he wants to do away with the workers' rights to come together to bargain for a middle-class life. But let me give you these facts. The five states in the United States that prohibit collective bargaining by public employee, they have a cumulative debt of $222 billion. Collective bargaining didn't cause that. Look, this isn't about public employees. This was caused by the crisis and the recession that we have. You have 15 million people out of work. Put them back to work. They pay taxes. The economy starts to hum. And all of us start to do that, live better. And this governor, instead of creating the jobs that he was elected to do, is now trying to destroy more middle-class jobs that will hurt the Wisconsin economy even more.
You know, Rich Trumka, the way he and other governors frame this, though, is they're saying this is an argument between all the citizens of one of the state, in this case Wisconsin, versus the public workers. And he said when it comes down to that balance, public workers should be willing to give some.
Well, you know, they have been. He asked for cuts, and they agreed to all the cuts that he asked for. Remember this. Those public employees are citizens as well. This is a concerted campaign by a number of Republican governors to vilify public employees. This governor, Walker, first said that Wisconsin employees are paid too much. Well, now we know from study after study that the public employees are paid less than private employees. And then he said it's about the pension plan. And then we find out that his pension plan is nearly fully funded, 100% of assets versus liabilities. And then he says, well, I need these cuts. And they agreed to them. And then again, the most outrageous thing that he did was say to these employees, I'm going to lay you off unless you give up your rights. Now, no American should be subject to that. We ought to be doing more to build the middle class, not less. And what he's trying to do is take away nurses, firefighters, EMTs, snowplow drivers, their ability to come together to make their way into the middle class.
But if his argument and the argument we had Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana on the program the other night, and in effect, they're saying that collective bargaining is bargaining over the public's money. It's not money. I heard Governor Daniels said to us in an interview the other night, he said, it's not money that belongs to an individual or a company. It's the taxpayers' money. So there's something out of whack here bargaining over
of
that.
Of course, but you have to have quality employees. Take John Kasich. He says everybody has to share. When he came in, he gave his senior staff a 30% increase in wages. And then he turns around to public employees and says, now I want to strip you not only of the pensions you've been promised and the health care that you've been promised, but I want to take away your ability to negotiate for those. Look, in a modern society, in a global economy, the companies that succeed are the companies that sit down with their employees and they say, we have a problem, let's solve it. The old way of doing things, the Kasich way, the Walker way, is saying, employees, you have nothing to offer. Shut up and sit down and accept what we give you. And the last point I'd make about that, Judy, is that remember something. public employees are taxpayers as well.
Well, let me, I want to pick up on that because, you know, making that point, are you, how worried are you that if Governor Walker wins this argument in Wisconsin, that there could, that it just builds and makes stronger the argument against unions in these other states? But I mean, we already
see this.
This
isn't an argue about unions. Happening. This isn't about unions. This is about a governor taking away the rights of his employees to come together to bargain for a middle-class way of life. And if he takes that away, imagine what the country would be like if there were no unions. Governor Walker could come in one day and say, oh, in order to get the balance to budget, we're going to start paying, employers can pay women less for what the same work that men do. Or we're going to do away with overtime. Or we're going to do away with the age limit. Those are the type of things that are at stake because teachers right now, you know what they bargain for? They bargain for smaller class size. You know what police bargain for? They bargain for equipment that'll save their lives out on the street. They want to take that away from them. Now, a police officer knows what they need. A firefighter knows what they need. And a teacher bargaining for a smaller class size is trying to bargain for all of us.
So do you view Wisconsin as a kind of Waterloo for these issues that you care so deeply about?
You know, any time that they're taking any employee, any worker's rights away and saying to them, as Governor Walker did, you have to give up either your job or your rights. We take that seriously, and we're going to stand with them and fight. Or what Governor Kasich did. What they did in Ohio was corrupt, what that committee did. In the middle of a vote, they didn't have the votes, so they removed somebody from the committee. Now, that is a corrupt way to run government. If you can't win, you remove people from the government. That's how they passed that bill. And I'll say this to you. We'll stand with those employees. They want to fight for their rights. They want to fight for the middle class. They want to fight for the opportunity to get to the middle class. And we're going to be with them every step of the way.
Let me finally ask you about the view of Americans broadly, public workers who've been hearing this argument. And they hear that when you put the package together, public workers, they may be on balance when it comes to pay, but when you add in the benefits, the pensions, the health care benefits, that it's a richer package than what other workers may get across the board. So what do you say to American, to private sector workers who are watching right now, so, who think public workers get a better deal?
So in some cases they might, but in most cases they don't. Take Wisconsin. If you have a college degree in Wisconsin, you get paid 25% less than people with a college degree in the private sector. But here's what I'd say to them. In America, we've never, as a country, looked up and said, that person over there has a pension, let's take it away from them. What we as a country have always said is, they don't have a pension, let's figure out a way to get them one. We're the richest nation on the face of the earth. Corporate America had record profits. It's not that we can't afford this. We need a shared sacrifice. Workers have shared, they've given up their jobs, they've lost their homes, they can't go anymore. It's time for us to come together and create jobs so that we can create the America that all of us love and have revered around the world.
Rich Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
As we do. And once again, our invitations to Republican governors and others remain open, and we will bring you that perspective at a later date.
I attended several rallies against SB 5 and heard Richard Trumka speak at one, along with the late Congressperson John Lewis. Richard Trumka was practically obligated to speak out also on the issue of police brutality, as the AFL-CIO includes several police unions in its membership. Trumka traveled to Missouri and spoke at length on that question at this speech in Ferguson.
I got to tell you, it's great to be here in St. Louis, and I'm grateful to be here at such a critical time for Missouri, for our nation, and for our labor movement. Now, this hall is filled with leaders who have done so very, very much to protect working people. I mean all working people in Missouri. You've built strength through unity across industries and across crafts, across the length and the breadth of this great state. And this is the hard one in America in 2014. You build it across party lines. Now, as a labor movement, I don't have to tell you that we face, once again, concerted attacks by those who have enormous, enormous wealth. The far right trying to divide us in many ways, but here in America, the power and the dignity of working people will always win as long as we stay united. Now, I'm going to stray from my usual convention speech, and I'm going to talk about something that may be difficult and maybe even uncomfortable. But I believe what I'm going to say absolutely needs to be said. See, the question of unity brings up a hard subject, a subject that all of us know about, but quite frankly, few want to acknowledge, and that's race. I'm talking about race in America and about what that means for our communities, what it means for our movement, and what it means for our nation. Because the reality is that while a young man named Michael Brown died just a short distance from us in Ferguson from gunshot wounds from a police officer, other young men of color have died and will die in similar circumstances in communities all across this country. You see, it happened here, but it could have happened and does happen everywhere in America, because the reality is we still have racism in America. Now, some people might ask me why our labor movement should be involved in all that's happened since the tragic death of Michael Brown in Ferguson. And I want to answer that question directly. How can we not be involved? You see, union members' lives have been profoundly damaged in ways that can't be fixed. Leslie McSpadden, Michael Brown's mother, who works in a grocery store, is our sister and an AFL-CIO union member. And Darren Wilson, the officer who killed Michael Brown, is a union member too, and he's our brother. You see, our brother killed our sister's son. And we don't have to wait for the judgment of prosecutors or courts to tell us how terrible that very thing is. So I say again, how can we not be involved? See, this tragedy and all the complexities of race and racism are a big, big part of our very big family. And they always have been. See, a union's like a home. And in any home, good things and bad things happen. And we have to deal with all of them, honestly. But that's a philosophy. And we can't leave it at that. We have to look at real life today. We can't wash our hands of the issues raised by Michael Brown's death. Now, that doesn't mean that we prejudge the specifics of Michael Brown's death or deny Officer Darren Wilson or any other officer his or her rights on the job or in the courts. But it does demand that we clearly and openly discuss the reality of racism in American life. See, we have to take responsibility for the past. Now, racism, unfortunately, is part of our inheritance as Americans. Every city, every state, and every region in this country has its own deep history with racism. And so does the labor movement. See, right here in St. Louis in 1917, powerful corporations replaced white workers with African-American workers, recruited from the Mississippi Delta with offers of wages far, far higher than anyone could ever make sharecropping. And in response, the St. Louis labor movement helped lead a bloodbath against the African-American community in East St. Louis. Now, no one really knows how many men and women and children were killed, and how many houses and businesses were burned. But the NAACP estimated that up to 200 died and 6,000 were left homeless. Now, Eugene V. Debs, the founder of the National Railway Union, called the East St. Louis massacre, and I quote, a foul blot on the American labor movement. Now, it was one of the single most violent events in the history of American racism. And it scarred the city. And it scarred our labor movement. And it scarred our country. See, when I think about an event like that, and there are plenty in our history all over this great country, and not all of them so long ago, I really wonder what those white workers would say if they could stand here, right here today where we are. What would they say about the choices to embrace hatred and division over unity and strength? What would they say about corporate bosses playing the race card over and over and over again in the years after 1917, breaking unions, crushing hopes, and dashing out our dreams? Yet remember, we're here today because labor leaders like A. Philip Randolph and Walter Reuther showed us that there's a better way. Not just for our unions, but for our entire country. But this is not just about leaders of the past and tragedies of yesterday. You see, if we in the labor movement truly want to act as a positive force for change around issues of racism and classism, well, then we have to acknowledge our own shortcomings. We as a movement have not always done our best to support our brothers and sisters of color who face challenges both on and off the job. Challenges that you really don't understand unless you live them day in and day out. See, the test of our movement's commitment to our legacy is not whether we post Dr. King's picture in our union halls, but rather, do we take up the fight when the going gets tough, when the fight gets real, against the evils that still exist today? When a new immigrant gets mistreated by management because they don't speak the language, that's our fight. When an African-American worker doesn't get a promotion or fair pay because of the color of his or her skin, that's our fight. When women are paid less than men for the same work, that's a fight for every single one of us. You see, we can't afford any longer to have my issues and your issues. We must all stand together and mobilize around our issues. You see, we have a choice. We can either live our history or we can change it. Now, as you may be able to tell, the matter is deeply personal with me. See, when I sat at my conference table at the AFL-CIO, I look across the office at a picture of my dad. Now, he's gone. But if you've lost a parent, you know that they never stop talking to you. no matter how long. My dad was a miner, 44 years worth. He helped build the United Mine Workers. He bled for his union. And he went to war for our country in the Pacific in World War II, 52 months of it. And as I worked on this speech, this is what my dad said to me. He reminded me of something that happened when I was 5 or maybe 6 years old. You see, I come from a coal mining town in southwestern Pennsylvania called Nemacolin. And my best friend back then was a kid named Tom. And Tom was African American. And there was a park near us. It was called Shady Grove Park. It had a big swimming pool in it where you could pay to swim. And one day my dad drove us there to go swimming. And we came up to the toll booth to pay. It was one of those places where you pull up and pay for everyone that's in the car. And the guy looks in and sees Tommy in the car, and he tells my dad, he said, "That boy can't swim here. You know that. You know that he can't." My dad never raised his voice, but he said, "You better take out for that boy, because we're going to swim here." Now, I don't know whether they took out for Tommy or not, but we went in, and me and Tommy went to the changing room, and we jumped into the pool. And it was a hot day, and the pool was packed. Wasn't any room anywhere. But it was like all of a sudden where we went, a circle of water opened up all around us. And when we moved, the circle of clear water just moved around wherever we went. Well, we swam until we got tired, and then we got out and we dried off and we got something to eat, and that was that. Later, I asked my dad about the man in the booth. I wanted to know why he didn't like Tommy. And my dad explained that it didn't have anything to do with Tommy, but with the color of Tommy's skin. I protested. I said, "That's not fair." My dad said, "That's the whole point." So let me come back to what happened at Ferguson specifically. It isn't fair. And that's the whole point. See, I have a son. He's not so young anymore, but he's not so old. And I don't worry about him. Well, maybe a little bit. I don't know, but I have a suspicion, like many of you, and certainly like me at that age, that he may not always obey the nation's traffic laws. So while I worry that he might wrap himself around a tree, I never worry that when he goes for a cross-country road trip or a night on the town that he may be stopped and shot to death by a police officer. But for millions of mothers and fathers of young African American men and boys, men just like my son, and boys that were as young as me and my friend Tommy, kids with promising futures in America, that's a constant fear. A constant fear. And if you don't feel that fear yourself, I just ask you, just for a moment, to think about what it would be like to feel that every time your son went out that door. See, think about what it would be like to watch your kid walk out the door and wonder, with good reason, if it's the last time you'll ever see him alive. Because we know it happens. And if you haven't had a close call yourself, you know, people who have, friends, family, neighbors, people you worship with. And it doesn't stop there, unfortunately. See, teenagers of all races often experiment with drugs. But only some of our sons and daughters are suffering terrible long terms in prison for the same nonviolent petty crimes which we all know some of the people in this room did as kids as well. And you can't get around the fact that those prisons are filled disproportionately with people of color. And that's not somebody else's problem, brothers and sisters. This is the reality of life for millions of our brothers and our sisters. And so it's our problem. And that's what solidarity means. Now, brothers and sisters, I know there are no easy answers. We must use the occasion of the tragic death of Michael Brown and its aftermath here in St. Louis to begin a serious and open-ended conversation about what we can do and about what we should do. See, the conversation that needs to be about racism and some other things as well. Call it classism. Call it for the blindness of our nation, of all the poor, of all races and nationalities. Call it contempt for the people who do the work in our country. But it needs to be addressed. Because consider this. We live in a country of runaway inequality, of widespread desperation amid staggering, staggering wealth. And in truth, we asked our public sector workers to manage this for us. And then our politicians and our media blame them no matter what happens. Blame the teacher in the defunded school, the firefighter with 20-year-old equipment, and the nurse who's given yet another 12-hour shift. And think about what it means to be a police officer in this country, where violence is so often the norm. Think about walking up to a car, anticipating the worst over and over again every single day. Now, none of us can really know the toll that that takes unless we've worn the uniform and walked in those shoes. So this reality, this experience, must be part of any conversation about how we move forward from what has happened here in Ferguson. But the answer starts with candor, not firepower. See, we can't militarize our police. A free society is policed by a civilian police force, democratically accountable to the community that it protects. Now, of course, our officers need the equipment and the training and the staffing to protect themselves and to protect us. But let's not forget what our history teaches us. Because it's always the employers who want the paramilitary forces, the National Guard, the bayonets and the armored cars, and the weapons always end up pointed at us. Pointed at us. And the decision to militarize is always made way up the chain of command, not by the citizenry or by the rank and file police officers. So we've got to talk to each other, not past each other. And we got to talk about how to help our police officers serve our community. We've got to talk about registering and educating voters about jobs and housing and about raising wages for all of us. And we've got to talk about accountability, making sure the public has confidence that the laws our nation will be enforced and enforced equally and fairly. And we have to do more than just talk. First, we have to listen. And then we have to act. See, I'm not saying this is easy. If I knew how to fix the hurt in our communities, I would tell you. I honestly would. But I do know how to start. And that's by listening. So later today, I'm going to be doing a lot of listening here at this convention and then at a meeting in Ferguson with the leaders of that working class community. Because we as a labor movement have to be part of the communities that our members live in. Brothers and sisters, just as it was true 100 years ago when we try to move forward, there will be people who will try to foment racism, try to divide us, separate us for their own benefit. And those are the same people who always want to set workers against each other, private sector workers against public sector workers, native born against immigrants. And about that, I can only say this. If we let that happen, we lose every time. Not once in a while, not occasionally, but we lose every time we're allowed to be divided. So it's time to draw the line. Some people are still getting hurt in our communities because of the color of their skin, and that's not right. One moment of bad luck, one dumb mistake, one misstep shouldn't end a life. Nor should it put someone in prison for decades and rob them of the right to participate in our democracy for the rest of their lives. See, that's nothing but second-class citizenry. And that's wrong in America. And we can do better. See, the United States of America is the greatest country in the world. It's a beacon of hope. The very name America means freedom. It means fairness. It means justice. It means equality. And facing our problems, facing our flaws, is part of our greatness. Now, I know each and every one of you became involved in our labor movement because you hunger for justice. You hunger for fairness. It's in your blood and your DNA. And you've learned the hard way that justice and fairness just don't happen. We have to make it happen. We have to build power. We have to use that power to fight, and we can never stop. Because in this country, in the richest nation on earth, at its most rich point in time in history, fairness and justice really aren't too much for us to be asking for. Whatever the color of our skin, whoever we love, no matter our gender, our religion, or anything else, because we're the workers of America. From the hotel to the high school, we lay the foundations. We teach the classes. We drive the buses. We build the roads. Brothers and sisters, we lift the loads and answer the call. We do whatever it takes, no matter the cost. We wake our country up every morning, every single day. We tuck her to bed every night, and we won't be turned aside, and we won't be divided. This is our country, and it is time we took this country back for every last worker out there, black, yellow, red, and brown. I said that I hope the tragedy of Ferguson can push us to make positive change. And I'm hopeful this change has already begun to happen. I know that I've been changed. Yet as a community, we have a long, long way to go. And we have a lot of work to do. Now, I don't have to tell anyone here how our labor movement operates. We carry out our activism in our communities, in the workplace, and we carry out our activism at the ballot box. And quite frankly, we're ramping up all three of those right now. And it's a good thing, too, because the time is right. You see, for 40 years, we've been living a story of decline. And so much of what made our country great has been pushed into despair as our roads and bridges crumble and fall away, and public investment in social services and public education and housing and transportation and research and medicine have all been cut so that politicians can give more tax cuts to the super rich, especially the 0.1%, not even the top 1%. And for decades, the far-right CEOs and billionaires have sought to divide us, to disempower us. In the past few years, we've seen a rash of voter ID laws to deny the vote to millions of people of color, to young people, and to the elderly. We've seen the demonization of immigrants. We've seen workers vilified. We've seen our rights attacked in Wisconsin and Ohio and Indiana and Michigan and right here in Missouri. But I got to tell you, that's the old story. There's a new story in America. And it doesn't come from Washington or our politicians. You see, working people are coming together for a change. We're standing together in the workplace, in the polling place, and in the streets. People are talking about collective action and economic inequality. People are talking about collective bargaining who never spoke the words before. We've marched together with fast food workers who demand fairness and dignity and a $15 an hour wage right here in St. Louis. And I got to tell you, my hat's off to those courageous workers. God love each and every one of them. And how about the Walmart workers taking on the richest family and the largest private employer in the world? And how about the men and women, predominantly people of color, who drive and fix the buses and staff the metro system right here in St. Louis? No pay raise in 6 years. Now, I heard last night that a tentative deal was reached to save pensions. And while it's still subject to agency notification and union ratification, I really want to thank Mayor Slay for his help coming together and standing up for workers. Mayor, I know you're still in the room, and all I want to do is say thank you for standing up and talk and walking the walk, not just talking the talk. Let's give that man a round of applause for standing with workers. And how about the Missouri AFL-CIO? I got to tell you, I can't begin to tell you how proud I am of you. You built a bipartisan coalition to defeat right to work. Our opponents thought it was a done deal, and it wasn't, and it won't be. You see, we're living a new story in America. You see, working people stand united in our desire for economic change. And a powerful majority, not just union members, want the minimum wage raised. And an even larger majority wants good American manufacturing jobs and a rebuilt infrastructure, not more bad trade deals and corporate tax ripoffs. So between now and November 4th, we, collectively, all of us, have a chance to show candidates that supporting a working family's agenda, our agenda, America's agenda, is a sure way to win. We can demonstrate how powerful unity is, and we can win for candidates who want to raise wages and who will represent all of us and who will make work lift us up, not hold us down and trap us in poverty. You see, right now we have a chance to grow power for Missouri's working families with our political program across our society. And in that effort, we need every single one of you, every single one, to fully engage in Labor 2014. If you haven't released staff, release staff. Unless, of course, you like things the way they are. If you do, if you think this economy has just been wonderful to you and we'd be even greater to your kids, do nothing. Do nothing. But if you think we ought to change, then we got to do it to keep out right to work and to defeat the constitutional amendment attacking teachers' tenure. So we need you in the phone banks. Lead by example, knocking on doors. We need the face-to-face conversations. You see, that's how we win elections. I'm doing it. You go to the AFL-CIO and go in the phone bank, you'll see me there. You'll see me knocking on doors. You'll see me leafleting. You know why? Because when our members see us doing it as leaders, they know it's important. And they come out too. You can't sit behind a desk and tell everybody else to go do stuff unless you're willing to do it too. See, I want to tell you something. If you think we're in trouble now, it's going to get much worse if we don't get off our butts and work like hell between now and November 4th. So let's wake up before it's too late. Let's motivate those volunteers and strengthen our activists. We'll connect with more working class voters and we'll get more working families to the polls. And we need to be out in our communities building larger working class political alliances. See, that's how we break the isolation. That's how we fight racism. And that's how we win. Because we have a vision. We have a big vision of a better nation. And we're making it real, brothers and sisters. Because when all of us pitch in, we begin moving forward together in solidarity. Because we can learn from even the worst tragedy. Because all of us together have the power to make a new day for America. So let's get off our seat and on our feet, brothers and sisters, because when we stand together and fight together, we win together, we'll work for it, we'll fight for it together, all of us together, with solidarity, real solidarity, black and white, immigrant and native form, gray and straight, where your picket line is my picket line, and I honor that picket line without asking what the strike's about. My brothers and sisters are fighting, I fight with them, right? Arm in arm, every day, every single day, standing together, fighting together, voting together, winning together for a better America, a better tomorrow, and a better future. God bless you. Keep up the fight.
That was Richard Trumka, now deceased head of the AFL-CIO, speaking on the topic of racism and police accountability in Ferguson, Missouri. He died this week at the age of 72. Richard Trumka, presente. And thank you for being present in the radio sense and listening to this show, whether on WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM or WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. The show was conscious.